any sense of morality, any sense of humanity, when it is allowed, when it is allowing these kind of attacks to take place. And so in some ways, whilst we have lost hope in the West as coming coming to assist or coming to stop this kind of violence, I think that at the same time, we do appreciate international law, we do appreciate human rights, but we are going to make sure that they are implemented, universally, that they are implemented without any prejudice to one group of people over another.
Right, which begs the question, you know, where do Palestinians draw their hope from? They have lost hope in the Western world, the Arab countries who own 1/6 of the world's wealth. They're not doing enough to put an end to the bloodshed, to say the least. But, gentlemen, we're going to pause here because we're going to hear from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, called on U.S. President Joe Biden to personally intervene to stop the war in Gaza. In a televised address broadcast over the weekend, Abbas spoke of the worsening humanitarian crisis in the besieged enclave.
President Biden, I urge you with all your official and humanitarian qualities to stop this humanitarian catastrophe, or rather this genocide against our innocent people, for which history will hold no one innocent, and to provide relief to our people trapped in Gaza. This war must be stopped immediately. How can this genocide be justified as self-defense? In reality, they're war crimes that deserve punishment. The horrific massacres committed by the Israeli occupation forces against our Palestinian people in Gaza, including the most recent ones in Al-Fakhoura and Tel Zatar schools today, which claimed the lives of hundreds of forcibly displaced people from their homes, once again compel me to demand that you and world leaders assume responsibility to stop this aggression and the crimes of genocide against our people. So far, over 42,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, have fallen victim, in addition to the widespread destruction of tens of thousands of homes, schools, hospitals, places of worship, public facilities, and infrastructure.
And we're back with our guests to continue the conversation. Matthew, I want to pick up on something we were discussing earlier. That's the United Nations. And when it comes to resolutions issued against, adopted against Iran, for example, you remember the Iraq War and the, you know, vial that Colin Powell held at the United Nations to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The UN seems to be able to implement those resolutions. But when it comes to Palestinians or the Gaza Strip or what's happening right now, it's completely toothless. Are they losing legitimacy altogether?
I think the United Nations is a great institution. I've been to the United Nations and it's inspiring, really. But it's been toothless for a very long time. There was the hope, as I'm sure you know, in the aftermath of the Cold War in the 1990s, that the UN could finally be the thing that it was set up to be, to promote peace and self-determination, which is, of course, very relevant to the Palestinian people right now. And there was a growth in the relevancy of the United Nations in the 1990s, but only because it was driven so hard by the United States, and only because the United States was having its unipolar moment, its most powerful moment. Mm-hmm. After 9/11, the role of the United Nations, even that little uptick that it had in the 90s, it's really been a particularly toothless tiger since then. It's great that international law is there, and that's been set up by all of these countries working together, and it's so important for peace, security, and justice. But the last 20 years, it's not really been able to fulfill that mandate whatsoever.
Now, I mentioned we would be talking about apartheid Israel and apartheid South Africa, and Mohammed, this is a question for you. In the words of Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki, if there is any country or countries that can comprehend the suffering and the struggle for freedom and independence of Palestine, it is the African continent and the people of Africa. As a South African watching these horrific events unfold, how do you, you know, see it all as far as apartheid is concerned?
So, Saeed, let me first maybe start off backwards. In some ways, what we are seeing is far, far worse and more horrific than what South Africans ever experienced during the days of apartheid. We never had F-16 bombers and Apache helicopters flying over our townships or flying over our residential areas, dropping bombs, missiles, and destroying entire buildings. We never saw the kind of death rate that we are currently witnessing in the Gaza Strip. So in many ways, even the very definition of Israel as an apartheid state is soon becoming irrelevant, because we are more beginning to see it as a genocidal state. Our own president, and I don't use these words lightly, our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa, most recently has described what is happening to the Palestinian people as a genocide and as a Holocaust. Our ruling party, the African National Congress, has also made similar remarks, similar statements. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, the head of cabinet, the minister responsible for communicating all decisions from our administration, have all in the last 4 weeks described what is happening as a Holocaust and as a genocide. And so I do think that these two other words and definitions now need to be interrogated. However, to go to the issue of apartheid, I think that from the early 2000s, this is when the terms first started gaining traction. And it started gaining traction in a mainstream sense when the World Conference Against Racism took place in Durban in South Africa. It was at this conference that that organizations and governments started labeling Israel as an apartheid state in protest against the criticism that Israel and the Israeli regime was facing. The United States and Israel then boycotted and left that conference early. Thereafter, you have seen anti-apartheid icons, from Winnie Mandela to Archbishop Desmond Tutu and to various others across the board, that have described the situation of the Palestinian people as being very similar to that of the experience of Black South Africans under apartheid. However, I think that what has happened in the last 5 or 6 years is that we are now seeing not just a comparison between Israel and Israel's practices against the Palestinians to that of what apartheid South Africa imposed against Black South Africans. We're not just seeing a comparison, but we're also seeing a legal case being made that Israel that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid as defined by the Rome Statute and by the International Convention on the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid. I think that the United Nations and especially the ICC's prosecutor, who comes from Britain actually, has had ample evidence put forward to him by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, and various others. And I really do think that it is that it is concerning that the prosecutor within the ICC has not made any substantial moves in order to prosecute and in order to bring Israel to the ICC.
It certainly is concerning. There are a lot of words, there's a lot of evidence, but we're yet to see any concrete action on the ground by these organizations and institutions. Let me move on to Matthew, if that's okay. And Matthew, do you think this is a tipping point? You know, in the 1980s, I think it was 85, when the minority rule in South Africa realized, look, you can't crush the resistance, they're here to stay. And that sort of led to the downfall, if you will, or dismantlement of the apartheid system in the 1990s. Are we at that tipping point here in the territories?
I think it's a really important question. It's very difficult to predict the future. Obviously, apartheid became an international lightning rod in the mid-1980s, but it still took another 5 years for actual on-the-ground results to occur. It might be that we're at that stage now with Palestine. I definitely think it is encouraging that there were a million people out, or close to a million people out on the streets in London just a week ago. Mm-hmm. And as I say, that it's spread into all sorts of other towns and cities and around the world. So I think this might be the kind of Black Lives Matter for Palestine, and that could have very serious and important ramifications for changing the world. Is it a tipping point? Very difficult to know. It's very difficult to know. There's certainly not much talk at the moment of a what a tipping point would mean, which would be a Palestinian state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the moment, I think it's one of those things that, you know, the night is darkest just before the dawn.
You don't think the end is nigh, so to speak?
Well, the end might be nigh in a different way, particularly if the conflict spreads. Mm-hmm. We do have there's a broader concern here, which takes us a little bit away from the initial humanitarian disaster that's going on, which is that, of course, a conflict like this could escalate. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've had similar situation in Ukraine as well. Yes. Since February 2022 in particular. And there is, of course, the other geostrategic fault line, which is in the Taiwan Straits, I know, and with China. Mm-hmm. And so there are these three areas at the moment, all of which could go spectacularly out of hand. And then your question of is the end nigh would take on a rather an even darker and more sinister meaning.
So far, only the threat of that happening.
Yeah.
It's a matter of wait and see, like they say. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Matthew, the story about the, you know, calls for criminal investigations into Israeli war crimes. So there's one thing. We're seeing certain countries, not all of them, of course, recalling their ambassadors. Mm. There's a call for boycotting Israeli products or cutting economic ties with it. Do you think it's going to become a trend? Or will all of this, any of this, have any real impact on the Israeli regime moving forward?
I think a lot of it depends on the intransigence of the American empire. I think they are very consciously aware of how their reign as the global hegemon is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And whether they're in denial about that, or certainly they know that they need to do something about that if they want to maintain that power. And Israel is a key part of that. Mm-hmm. Israel, as President Biden has said before, if Israel didn't exist, then we'd have had to have invented it. And that is because it is their strategic outpost for economic and political domination in that region. So it's going to be very difficult for the United States leadership to pull back from that. That's their stated position. That's where they really want to be.
Yeah.
And this can lead to perverse results as well, which can be really horrific. I was just thinking back to one of Fahima's stories that she picked up about this separation of north and south in Israel. I mean, it's the
in
case.
In
Gaza. It's the case in during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. I looked at the statistics on this a few months ago. Obviously, the United States was there to protect the south of Vietnam because that was where the democracy supposedly was. But and against the communist dictatorship north, over 2/3 of the bombs that were dropped were in the south.
Wow.
Because they were, you know, that old saying, you know, we had to destroy the village to save it. They basically destroyed a country to save it. Mm-hmm. And didn't do anything like as much in the north. Mm-hmm. So these kind of acts of domination can lead to very extremely destructive and perverse results. And those kind of things are going to start to happen now as this conflict heats up even further, particularly if we, I think, go beyond Christmas. I think there's a kind of a tacit understanding and acceptance that perhaps this is going to wind up sometime in December.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then all bets are off as to where this goes. I know that the Arab countries don't really want to be involved,
yeah,
but how can they justify that to their populations if we go into the new year and we're still in the same position?
You raise a very good question. Mohammed, this has been a PR battle as well as a physical one. It seems there are still attempts to shape the media narrative in this conflict. How do you see it?
So I think that, as Matthew had said, that the tipping point, the end of this, the end of the dismantling of Israeli apartheid, in many ways will happen as the way in which it happened in South Africa, where it was a multitude of factors that then contributed towards the demise of the apartheid regime. It was the armed struggle, which played a vital and crucial role in our own liberation. It was the international community, and it was a civil disobedience on the ground and the underground as well. And so I think that likewise in the in this current situation that we are witnessing, I think that global empire and the U.S. domination is one factor, and that is already being challenged by, for example, the formation of BRICS or the rise of certain Latin American countries or Iran or various other countries to counter the sort of hegemony of the United States. Now, coming to the next part of it is the international, as you have put it, the sort of PR battle, the media battle. And I think that whilst on the one hand, U.S. platforms or U.S.-owned, U.S.-dominated platforms such as the Meta-controlled Instagram and Facebook, whilst we do have restrictions and we do have shadow bans and we have other sorts of limitations that people are experiencing, I think that we have, for one of the first times ever, we have seen, while notwithstanding these restrictions, we have seen the ability of Palestinian voices to be coming out onto the global stage. Whereas before, all media was controlled by the Israeli regime, any messaging had to go past the Israeli authorities. Now we are seeing people with their cell phones, with their IT gadgets, that are able to take this information and able to transfer it and communicate it into the international and global community. And I do think that this year is part of the mobilization that we are witnessing.
Exactly. And a lot of people you talk to tell you that they know someone in the Gaza Strip and they're in touch, and that's why these images have been getting out and spreading across the world, raising awareness about what's happening there. We are coming to the end of the show. Let me thank my guests once again, Matthew Alford and Mohammed Desai. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
This is back to reality.
Back to reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma once more at your service as the host. And then here we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Alaykum as-salam.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So, as the ritual of this program, I would like you to introduce yourself very much briefly.
Yeah, I'm Ali, and I'm from India, and I'm a student in the holy city of Qom.
Thank you.
And I'm Sayyid Mustafa, and I'm also a student here. I'm actually learning psychology here in Hawza. And I've lived in different parts of the world. Originally, I'm from Pakistan.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for being a part of Back to Reality.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. As you know, there are some times in life in which we need to be silent, but then there comes too much of things in the middle and we cannot do that. Well, let's talk about silence. And is it important to just to rein it in some of the time and to keep silent?
Sure, Warren. Why don't I start?
Salad, go first.
Yeah, sure. So it's definitely an interesting question about, you know, I think there is a time to be, you know, silent, and there is time to talk as well. And I think we sometimes forget the silent part of it. Normally, when we discuss things, we're normally focusing on how to talk, what's the best manner to talk, when to talk, right?
And to talk back, of course.
How to talk back, how to argue, for example, how to understand, how to speak, well, all these things. But we forget how important silence is itself.
Silence, for example, one of the benefits of silence, I would say, is that you listen to others when you're silent.
Exactly.
Right? If you're always talking, when are you going to listen to someone else?
You're not going to get the chance to understand other people's perspective.
Right. So that in itself shows you that silence is maybe just as important as learning how to speak. It's just as important to be silent and learn how to listen as well. That's a big part of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess like being silent or, you know, talking is actually subjective to the moment or the scenario. You know, we need to look at what is going around us, like what's the best thing to do, like being silent over here. And, or, you know, to speak out. And as Brother Munch mentioned, silence at times is not just helpful, but it is also required to learn things. You know, if you just keep on, talking, you don't get the chance to get the matter, get some knowledge. So in times you need to be silent sometimes and subjective to the time again. You need to speak out.
So let's make those moments clear from the very beginning. What are the moments when we need to be silent?
For example, I feel that, you know, the subjects and the matters that we are not very much, you know, we don't have very much knowledge about it.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't speak over there. So that'll just spoil the things. That'll make the things even worse.
So the first one is not to speak when you do not know much.
Yeah, when you have no knowledge, just, you know, try to be silent.
Yeah. And then?
And then I was just to add to that, I mean, if you're going to end up speaking about a topic that you don't know, many times you end up looking like a fool, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you're just going to look very arrogant. Yeah. I mean, you're just not going to look good, in it, you know. So it's just best to remain silent and look normal or just nice, right?
Yeah.
Why? Or you're just going to get to some troubles that are not meant to be.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So these were just only two moments or important situations in which you can stop talking and keep quiet. But then I'm sure there are more of situations in which we can keep silent. But let's go for a short break and then we'll be back to see the rest of the story. So, yeah, welcome back. This is RIB English Radio, Back to Reality It Is, and we're talking about silence and how important it is to keep silent sometimes. And if you want my idea, I would say most of the times, because, you know, talking is a responsibility, according to me. And for every single word you mention, you're going to be responsible and you're going to be asked one day, because sometimes unconsciously, you just say something that would break the heart of someone. You would say something without any intention, but then it would bring some bad blood between people and then a lot of situations like this. So, yes, it's good to be silent most of the times, according to me, but then it needs practice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so far we've discussed, you know, some of the benefits of silence, where we can use it. But silence is actually a topic that's also been greatly emphasized in our religion.
Exactly.
For example, we have a saying from Imam Ali. He said that silence is the sign of nobility and the fruit of the intellect. Right? If you think about, like, when you look at children are just talking and noisy all the time,
yeah.
Right? If an adult behaves that way, that's not a sign of great intellect, right?
Maturity.
Right. And I think we also have sayings, you know, according to the lines, that one of the doors of hell is through the tongue, right?
Exactly.
Like you said, it's a great responsibility. We can hurt people with our tongue. We can start fights with this, you know.
It could act like a sword.
Yeah, so it can create great harm as well. So silence is a discipline that we need to practice, and which will help us become better, right?
Exactly,
what are your thoughts?
Yeah. Just adding to that, you know, sometimes, as you mentioned, that we can harm others with our words, and maybe we're not even aware of it. That, you know, our words might harm someone, and we might make someone angry or sad. So, and again, the sister mentioned a very good point. You know, silence, maintaining silence most of the times is better. Just adding to that, there's also hadith that, you know, we are accountable of each and every word that we speak. So most of the times we need to make sure. So according to this, we can get to know that, you know, the lesser we speak, the lesser we commit mistakes, we make mistakes. And apart from that, like when to remain silent and when to speak, what I believe is we have a golden rule in Islam, not just for this thing. And that is ahamu milakan. You know, you acquire what is the most important thing or what is the most significant thing.
Was that the translation of what you just said?
Yeah, ahamu milakan. Okay. You just see, like deem whatever is the most significant thing.
Okay.
So you just see, like according to the situation, with respect to the situation, what is required over here? And you do accordingly.
And actually, we have a lot of narrations that sometimes silence is the best thing you could do. But according to this subject matter, there are a lot of narrations. And I'm sure we could still have some more about that. And by the way, now we're saying we're talking on the importance of silence, but sometimes it's not good to keep silent. So we have both at the very same time.
Right,
we
right.
should just look at this very thing that is just, it's working like a scale. We should prioritize which one is important. And different situations have got different consequences and they require different reactions. Sometimes silence is not the best thing you can do.
You're right. And that's when you have to speak up. For example, you have to speak up for justice, right? You have
exactly.
to speak up against oppression. There are times when you don't have to be silent. Like, for example, if I'm teaching someone, I can't be silent if I'm teaching them. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we're discussing, it's sort of like, as the brother said, that, you know, it depends on the situation.
Exactly, and
One example I just wanted to bring up about where silence can be very helpful practically, which has really helped me in my own life, by the way, is in parenting. One thing that we don't realize is that with our children, one thing that we can use as a tool is silence. We don't always have to keep nagging them. We don't always have to keep speaking up against them.
I guess in all interactions, not just as parents, even with your friends, with your family members, with
definitely.
Other people in society.
But I mean, I bring this up because our teachers talk about it, right, in class, that as a tool for parenting, as a tool for as a father, one of the roles that you should play in the household is forgiveness and silence.
Exactly.
Right. I felt for me that was really helpful advice. It just helped me a lot in my home. Maybe
and
it
I would
someone else.
Say that sometimes by silence, you would teach people, even those people who are doing you wrong, when you do not answer them back, then there might be a bigger lesson for them that could be right. even more thoughtful than your words in a speech. So, Brother Ali?
Yeah, in contrast to remaining silent, if you talk about when we should speak up.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, sometimes it is wrong to remain silent where you should actually speak up. The wrongdoings in justice, as brother mentioned, like, you know, when someone is getting oppressed.
Yeah.
So over there, you don't have to remain silent. You need to raise your voice over there.
Exactly.
So in these kind of situations, it's actually wrong to remain silent.
Yeah.
You know, you're remaining silent over here can actually strengthen the enemy. So
these are
the times where you need to speak up and raise your voice.
So we're just saying that it's good to be silent and it's one of the tools to teach people, as the brother mentioned. But then again, there comes some times when we have to speak up.
Yeah.
Just like for justice, for when we see someone is oppressed and we could be the voice of the silent people. In those situations, I guess it's just unthoughtful to stay silent. Well, let's go just for a short break and then we'll be back for the last part of today's episode.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Well, this is Back to Reality. You're still listening to us and we're talking about silence, something which is very important, but sometimes we forget, or maybe we do not have the skill, or we maybe have never practiced that in our life, so that we cannot just bring it into practice. So why sometimes I can't stay silent?
you know, the crucial factors that can stem this problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I have got a few points that can be the factors, the various factors. Sometimes it's the emotional reactivity of a person.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes in the mm-hmm. tense situations and sometimes in times of anger and anxiety, it is difficult for the person to stay silent. And he mm-hmm. just, you know, he just...
Everything comes out.
Yeah, just everything comes out of his mouth. Yeah. So he just says everything. So in these situations, you know, kind of emotional people, it's hard for them to stay silent.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's the communication habits. You know, some people, we identify them as like very talkative in the society.
Yeah. I'm sure psychological right. people would have a lot to say on that.
Yeah, I'm saying one thing that you mentioned about anger, you know, anger is a time when we are told to be silent, by the way.
Exactly. You can worsen up the things.
That's probably one of the most like critical times when you should be silent. Like yeah. that will help you control your anger, right? But yeah, there's a lot to say about this. But go ahead, yeah. Finish your...
Yeah, and the second one, you know, the people who are talkative, they just have to share their opinion on mm-hmm. each and everything.
Yeah, it's a habit.
although it's not required. So this is... And somewhat related to this, there are these people who fear of missed out. Again, you know, they the same thing.
You mean they're misunderstood?
No, they feel like, you know, missed out. You know, in the conversation, there's a conversation going on. They're like, you know...
Oh, they're left out of the conversation.
They yeah. don't want to feel left out.
I see.
So they have to just... Like shoving their opinion.
Mm-hmm. And sure.
As if they guess, don't talk, everybody would think they are just deaf and they cannot talk. They're not hearing the yeah. conversation.
So, I mean, it's what you're saying is that a lot of times you develop a habit, right? And it can become a negative habit
yeah.
Of doing that. I mean, silence is, I think, almost like a tool, right? Mm-hmm. Like we said. Imagine like you're carrying a hammer around with you all the time. You don't want to like just... continuously wave that hammer around with you all the time. Otherwise, you'll destroy things, right? You only want to use it when it's required. And I think that's, by the way, the irony is that we're talking about silence, right? So I just found that to be
yeah,
ironical.
And that was a good, actually, metaphor to use, like the hammer. And
but yeah, you want to use it when it's required. So you want to talk when it's required to talk. You don't want to just damage things. And right.
Exactly.
Mistakes.
And I think those people who talk too much, their words would lose that authority that they actually expect their word to have. When you talk too much, even those people who are around you would not take you seriously because that's a habit of yours and nobody would care about your words because they think like, okay, it's their habit and they've got used to talking. So there is not much of value for the words you speak around people. That's why... we have to control it. We have to rein it in sometimes, just as the brother mentioned, that hammer, you can use it somewhere so important and crucial and in occasions when you just have to speak. First thing first, you have to be patient. And then I guess silence is going to be a helper. This was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for staying with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة Let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe. استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We continue in our review of this topic of how do you live, or how do we live rather, the Islamic life. And we've been looking at a lot of topics over these last nights. Tonight the topic is more of how, when we put everything together. And what we want to look at is the concept of a functional family. So whereas even last night we looked at a very individualistic topic about technology and the banes of technology, we mentioned the fact that there is a much good that comes out of technology, but there is also a lot of harm. But when we look at all of these topics that we have been looking at over these last few nights, we come to this topic tonight of the family. How does Islam envision a functional family? What is a functional family? And how do we get to that state where, as individuals, although we are individuals, but that we are able to come together and form a family that is based upon the ayat of the Quran, where Allah gives us the ideals of a Muslim family. And obviously we see the perfect example in the life of the Prophet and in the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salatu was-salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. You know, when we look at our existence on this earth, we recognize that out of all of the relationships that we ever have, marriage is one of the few that Allah gives us the right to choose. We all came into this world from a mother and a father. Nobody has the right to determine their parents. Allah chooses. Allah chooses some souls to go into the family of a Muslim family, some to go into a Shia family. Allah chooses other souls that were in the pre-earthly existence to be born into a Jewish, into a Christian, into an atheist, into an agnostic family. This is determined by Allah where every soul goes. We have no choice. When you look at our siblings, right? We're born, our mother and father create us. Allah obviously creates, but our father and mother, they conceive us and we're born. And our siblings are also not chosen by ourselves. Whatever we get, we get. Right? And we are asked to deal with that, whatever we get. Sometimes we get great siblings or parents. Other times, know that, you know, there are challenges within a particular family. And so, whereas we cannot choose our parents, our siblings, other relationships, grandparents, so on and so forth, Allah has given us the opportunity, as He shows us in the Quran, that we have the ability to choose our own spouse. Every man has the right to choose who he will marry in terms of his wife, his life partner, and every woman has the right to choose who she will marry to be her husband, and who will be that one that they will hopefully live their rest of their lives with. When Allah speaks about this institution of marriage, which, you know, even the hadith tell us that there is no institution which is more beloved to Allah than the institution of marriage. You know, it goes to the extent where the hadith of the Prophet tell us that when you marry, not only are you're completing half of your religion, but acts of worship like the salat, which pre-marriage had a certain reward. Once a man and woman get married, that prayer, the reward is magnified umpteen times. And many other acts of worship become much more rewarded by Allah when a person is married and they engage in that same act of worship. So in chapter number 24, verse number 32, Surat Nur, you know, a few nights ago when we spoke about the modesty of Islam, we looked at verses 30 and 31, if I'm not mistaken, from Surah An-Nur, where Allah told the men to lower their gaze, where Allah then told the women to lower their gaze and then wear the hijab, or wear the modest clothing that Allah has spoken about in the ayat. When you get to verse 32, Allah then begins to speak about marriage, about this union between a man and a woman. And look at how Allah words it. He says in the verse, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَأَنْكِهُ الْأَيَّامَ مِنْكُمْ وَالصَّالِحِينَ مِنْ عِبَادِكُمْ وَإِمَائِكُمْ إِنْ يَكُونُوا فُقَرَى يُغْنِيهُمُ اللَّهُ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ وَاللَّهُ وَاسِعٌ عَلِيمٌ. He says in the verse that talking to men and women, he says, marry those amongst you who are single, and those of your male and female slaves that are righteous and fit for marriage. Now, obviously, this verse of the Quran is speaking about a time in Medina where there was active slavery. We know that Islam tried to eradicate slavery. It was not able to do it overnight because of the political and the social circumstances. So there was a time where slavery existed. At the time of the Prophet, at the time of the Imams, many of our latter Imams, they were slaves. And the Imams had them as their wives, and many of our Imams were born from these women. So Allah is saying that when it comes to the free men and women who are single, they have to get married, and also the slaves that are in the possession, that they also have a right to have marriage. And then Allah says something which is, an indicator for all of us, especially the youth who are not yet married and are worried about it. Because, one of the concerns many youth tell me, or their parents also share, is that my daughter or my son doesn't want to get married right now. Mostly the son. Why? Well, they say he's still at university. He doesn't have a good job. He doesn't have a house. Doesn't have a car. He's not yet on his own 2 feet. And so financially, he's not in a position to marry and take on that responsibility. But Allah responds to that, and He says, إِنْ يَكُونُوا فُقَرَىٰ يُغْنِيهُمُ اللَّهُ مِنْ فَضْلِ. If they are poor, if they don't have the financial well-being to get married, Allah says He will enrich them out of His grace. So brothers and sisters, wealth or lack thereof should never be an obstacle in marriage. I know it is for many people, but sometimes that is because as a society, as our various cultural backgrounds, we are expected to maintain a certain status quo. We're expected for our marriages to cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. We're expecting the mahar to be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. We're expecting all of these grand celebrations in a wedding, which many times the youth, especially if they're in university or just graduating, that they can't afford. Maybe the parents are not in a position, they haven't saved, they have no financial ability to provide such a marriage, and so they end up forcing their children to delay a marriage. But as Allah says, if the children are not well-to-do, Allah will enrich them. Allah will make them self-sufficient. Allah will make them comfortable with whatever situation financially they find themselves in. Because as Allah says that He is wasi'un alim, He is all-embracing in His mercy and all-knowing. Now, I just want to spend a few moments on this verse because, again, the first part of my talk is about this construction of a family, a successful, pious family, one that is a functional family, as we've said.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur قيوم رؤوف صابر مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه. We'll be right back.
forbidden files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugar cane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule. During a time when slavery was the norm in many countries, Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about its 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. And so it's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for a country that is so small and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. So you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? If your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative, met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004. The year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep, deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that these black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, there's you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think ever, you know, so if you see that and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which is barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S. led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military, U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. And then, but what was, what the reason, the way that we, they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war. So a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group, the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States, and they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in Libya and Algeria and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations. Right. So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So, for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back that you have this coup d'etat. I mean, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country.